Hi, my name is Kunal, and welcome to the Geeks of the Valley podcast, which connects with some of the brightest minds globally who are leading their respective industries today to discuss the hottest upcoming industry trends and how their work is affecting the global economy. This morning from the San Francisco Bay Area, we have the NEA Venture Partner and current founder and general partner of Tenacity Venture Capital joining us today. Please welcome Ben Narrison. Ben, really great to have you back on the podcast again.
Always fun. Thanks for having me.
No worries at all. And what have you been up to since we last spoke? It seems like you've been making some pretty big moves in the industry here in the venture space recently with this new fund.
Yeah, well, I spun out of NEA to start a new seed fund, which sort of returns me to my roots. I started one of the first institutional seed efforts in the world back in 2007. So, you know, I've been doing it for 14 years, and now I'm going to do it instead of for another fund. I'll do it for my own.
That's exciting to hear. Can you tell us a bit about this fund and its strategy and maybe how this focus differs from what you were doing at NEA?
Well, I'll start with the second question first. You know, at NEA, you know, NEA's current fund is about $3.6 billion. With a total of about $26 billion of committed capital. And with a fund of that size, you know, I was much more focused on later stage rounds. The most material round I did for NEA was a $80 million investment in a firm called Divvy Pay, which we invested in about 2 years ago, and which sold to Bill.com for $2.5 billion of cash and public stocks. So, you know, deploying $80 million into a deal and getting a very nice return, but you know, a smaller multiple and a bigger IRR is sort of a big part of what my purpose was at a fund like NEA. My fund, Tenacity Venture Capital, it's all about seed. You know, this is basically anything before the Series A, pre-seed, seed, formation deals, even incubations. And, you know, you're going in at the very earliest possible moment. And, you know, it's sort of the journey of zero to one, which I have spent a lot of time on. I mean, I was a founder for 25 years, and I've funded 109 companies in the last 14 years. So I spent a lot of time both as a founder and helping other founders with the zero to one journey. And what it boils down to is, you know, I want to find companies that have sort of uncapped upside, future public companies, and help them with the navigation to the point of being viable for a tier one, high quality Series A round. And so that's how I pick companies, and that's where I help. And then I help them with their fundraise, and then they have new folks to help. And hopefully it just continues on from there. So very, very different set of realities, very different amount of value add, very different amount of participation. You know, I'm not a guy that's there all the time, but I'm there to help. And if I can help you figure out what it takes to get to Series A and then help you raise that Series A, that's when I and my founders are the happiest.
I remember on our last podcast, you kind of discussed this three-step theory. Can you tell us if that's evolved over this period of time and how it's changed when looking at investing in startups?
Well, I think what you're probably referring to is that I've often said I need five things to make an investment. People, a great idea, and a huge market. And so in essence, it's three things. It's just that one of them is triply important versus the others. You know, I would say it remains true. I still have a single-minded focus on looking for entrepreneurs that make me say, wow. And the entrepreneurs themselves, the quality, tenacity, intelligence, drive, vision of the entrepreneurs is by far the most important thing. However, I do need them also to have an idea that I actually want to back. You know, I'm sort of the polar opposite of a Y Combinator model, where they're looking for brilliant engineers that might find an interesting business. I want people to already have figured out a great idea before I fund them, because I'm not a big fan of pivots. Pivots are very dangerous, often fatal, and not the part of the journey I want to take part in if I can avoid it. Now, that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. I want my entrepreneurs to try till they die in terms of the dollars they raise should all be spent trying. Even if what they were trying fails, they should keep trying. I don't want my money back. So, you know, but having said that, I really want to believe in the idea that they're coming to me with and follow that journey, not sort of hope that they come up with an idea later that's fundable.
And Ben, what is it like to start a venture firm? You know, a lot of people say it's similar to starting a startup, right? With a startup, you're betting on a product, but in a venture fund, the product is you, right? People are investing based on your past skill set.
So raising a venture fund is very similar to being an entrepreneur in a lot of ways. The primary way is that I am out there pitching for money. So I am basically telling this story over and over again to people that I hope will be interested in putting money to work with me. And that's the same thing an entrepreneur does, except they're selling their business and I'm selling my ability to fund companies. When I started doing this, I was told it would take a year. That was pretty common advice. But I was also told I might as well go ahead and start having the conversations, because since it takes a year, you might as well start those conversations even before you have a legal entity set up and you've got all your docs done. And I did that. And then 25 days after I started, I had more than half the fund committed. So I'm actually currently scrambling to get my docs and my lawyers and my back office and all that set up. It's a good problem to have. I'm not complaining, but it was a very interesting learning. Now, you know, my friends have been sort of surprised and impressed with that, and I'm pretty proud. I think it's, you know, as one person said, that's probably top 1%, which is also my fund results, when it comes to how long it takes to raise a new fund. But I think net, the reason for that is I spent 14 years building a track record. You know, I've got three what appear to be top 1% fund equivalents, you know, 14x, 6.5x, and 5.5 funds behind me already. If I take the investments I've made over time, personally, break them into 3-year chunks and sort of think of that as a fund equivalent. So that's what people are funding. It's sort of like the difference between raising a seed round for a concept and raising a Series C for a high growth, high velocity company. Like, I've already got the track record. What's interesting is people are so used to hearing from, like, I'm a new fund, but I'm not a new manager. And I think people are so used to hearing from new managers that sometimes it's confusing to them because I'm a generalist. And they're like, well, why don't you have a focus? And my focus is to repeat the 1% success rate of the past. You know, I started doing seed in 2007. I was one of the first three institutional seed funds that existed, as far as I can tell. And back then, it was the most minute focus you could possibly have. But today, you know, the difference is when somebody, it's funny, a buddy of mine reached out and said, oh, I saw your journal, the Wall Street Journal article. Can you help me? I'm thinking about raising a seed fund. And I was thinking, this is a nice guy. I like him. But he's always been a hired gun CEO, as far as I can tell. He goes into venture-backed businesses, goes in as a CEO. It's not the most obvious background for me for a seed fund, but I'm happy to talk to him about it. What I've noticed is that most people are doing it from scratch, realize it's a relatively crowded space. There's very few very high quality tier one blue bloods in this space, but it is crowded, even though a lot of it's noisy, so-so performing folks. And so if somebody new is going to raise money without a track record, they need to find a focus, because then the investors think to themselves, I don't have that covered. And from a quote unquote asset allocation standpoint, maybe it's important. Well, I was talking to a buddy once about portfolio construction, which is like the fund equivalent of asset allocation. And I was like, have you ever seen a perfectly constructed fund? And he said, yes, I saw a perfectly constructed fund using perfect portfolio theory once. And I said, how did it perform? He said, it's one of the worst performing funds I've ever seen. So, you know, yes, intellectually, I get that you want your assets to be diversified. And, you know, that's all great. But if somebody is conceptually pitching you with no track record at all, that you need to fund them because they're funding African fintech companies. And you think to yourself, I don't have enough exposure to Africa and I don't have enough exposure to fintech. What a great opportunity. Well, that's fine. As long as the person can show you that they haven't been able to deliver results, why do you care? I'm not saying they're not going to perform, but like net, I think I've benefited from having a 14-year track record that's very positive. You know, it's like I figured out what I do. I figured out how I do it, and I want to keep doing it. I don't want to change it for some marketing reason. It's sort of make one last point. Entrepreneurs often listen too much to investors, and sometimes they change their pitch because of it. It's absolutely fine to listen to people and ingest their information, but you got to apply it to your beliefs around the world. You know, I remember the story of Yahoo. They would not take money from anybody that wanted them to change their name. Same thing. Like, I know what I do well. I want to keep doing it. I don't need to change it. I'm not trying to be a jerk. It's just I'm going with history, performance, and data, and I'm trying to learn how to then make myself even better. And that doesn't appear to be some wholesale change in strategy when the strategy has worked. I don't need to be the football player that learns to play basketball or baseball. I need to be the football player that keeps winning whatever football players win. Games, obviously. World Series. I mean, the other thing, Super Bowls. Yeah, I'm not much of a sports guy. I should never use a sports analogy because I'll always screw it up.
I mean, but in a way, this is really, your strategy is really focused around this time machine or time machine, you know, concept, right? Whatever has worked in the past, I believe will work in the future.
Well, for my own patterns, for my own way to pick, you know, a lot of the best investors in the world on the venture side, when I've gotten to know them, will eventually say, at the end of the day, I'm a stock picker. Now, in the earliest of stages, being a stock picker is very much about the people and everything else I talked about. But if I have been able to pick well in the past, I'm not incented to change my patterns of how I pick until I find, I'll give you an example. You know, in the first 3 years, I funded 30 companies. And in the first 3 years, not a single one of them failed. And this worried me a great deal because I thought I wasn't taking enough risk. I was funding PowerPoint slides. I was funding entrepreneurs with brand new ideas that hadn't done anything yet. And so I decided I would loosen up my criteria. I would change my pattern because I wasn't taking enough risk and therefore I must have been damaging my reward. And it turns out I was wrong. I loosened up. I loosened up on the people and I had my very first failure. And what I started to notice was loosening up on the people was absolutely the wrong answer. There are other areas I needed to change, and I figured that out. But I ended up going from a roughly 14x realized fund to a 5.5x current value fund. And the fund after that was 6.5x. And I believe the reason that the second fund was less compelling than the third was that I had loosened up on the people and had let lesser quality entrepreneurs, less tenacious entrepreneurs, into that fund. And so I switched back and it all, you know, got better. Look, 5.5 is not bad. It's just not as good as the next one, which is 6.5 and is 3 years younger. I mean, there's room to grow in both of those portfolios quite a bit. But, you know, it was just a learning for me that you don't, you know, like if it's not broken, you don't need to fix it. You can optimize. You can, like, you know, if you're a race car driver, you lap the car and you note everything about it. And then you go and you try shift. And if it goes faster, that's your new standard. But if it slows down, you need to change the engine back. Right. And so, yeah, there's always this saying, like, you have to have all this disclosure in the front of a deck, which a lot of it boils down to prior performance is no guarantee of future result. Right. But that language, in my opinion, is really driven by the realities of the mutual fund industry. So, if you're running a massive mutual fund, you can take $10 million 10 different times and deploy it into 10 different strategies, right? And then whichever strategies work, you can market, and whichever ones fail, you can flush down the toilet. So, you know, it's not really fair to judge them on the strategy because it may or may not work again. When you're an individual, when you're a single human being, I can't spin up 10 versions of Ben. I've had one life to live and I can show you what it looks like. So I do think there's a disproportionate chance that that life should continue in the same manner. And when you look at data on venture, it is both fund and manager specific that people that have outperformed in the past tend to outperform in the future, because you're betting on somebody that has no way to optimize beyond their own intellectual abilities. They can't run different strategies. There's not Ben Narison version one and Ben Narison version two. There's just Ben Narison. And hopefully Ben Narison keeps doing what Ben Narison's been doing. And so far that's worked out well. So that's why the quote unquote time machine model, I think, makes sense for what I do.
Ben, I want to kind of dive a bit deeper into this tenacious, you know, founder, right? You had said that, you know, when you loosened up on founders, you know, they got lazy and they weren't as tenacious as maybe a founder that, you know, wasn't like that, right? And how, in your opinion, would you define like a tenacious founder?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of pithy little sayings one learns in the venture community. And one is like, you know, they've got to break through walls. The reality is, if entrepreneurship is an incredibly hard profession to choose, you know, other than being a first responder, I think it's the hardest world there is to be in. if you're not putting your life at risk every day, it's the hardest office job that exists, right? Every day you wake up, you're getting hit in the face with a virtual sledgehammer of disappointment. You're responsible for everybody that works for you. You got to raise money all the time. It's hard, 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 hard. And so if you have even the smallest inkling that you're going to give up, then you probably are, because it's so hard. So I look for founders I believe will not give up. Now, sometimes that can go too far. I have a founder. Remember I said I funded 30 companies in my first 3 years? And remember that I started in 2007? Well, 29 of those companies have either exited or are gone. And they generated a 14x roughly return. But one of those founders is still working. And at this point, 14 years in, I think he probably should find a landing and try something new. So having said that, the first company I ever had failed not because they ran out of money, but because the founder gave up. And I will always remember that. So my quest is always to try and figure out the answer to that question. I don't have the answer, and I will never be able to. You can't say to somebody, are you tenacious? Oh, yes, I am, will be the answer. You have to find the clues, the hints, the breadcrumbs in their past, in their activity, in their attitudes and beliefs and behaviors to know that when the times get really, really hard, when something that should take a year takes two, that they're going to keep going. Because here's the thing I have often had to counsel my founders, because they come to me in bad times as much as anything, because I think they know they can trust me to talk about difficult times. I mean, I know my money's at risk. I know I could lose all my money. That's part of this game, right? It's not something I look forward to, but it's not something I get upset about. It's funny. I was with one of my founders, and he introduced me to potential LP. This was a long time ago. And we were talking, and I was complaining bitterly about how a company I'd invested in had exited too early, and they'd sold for too little, and it was because their board was weak, and I made, I think, like 30 times my money on the first investment. And this founder of mine turned to the guy, he's like, Ben's amazing. I have never met anybody that can complain so much about making so much money. 30x is a good return, but it wasn't what it should have been. It could have been so much more. And I turned to him, I said, yes, that's true, but I've never complained about losing my money. And he looked at me and he's like, you're absolutely right. I lost every penny of your investment over an 8-year period, and you never complained once. Like, it's just the reality that you're in. So anyway, my point was, founders often come to me for difficult times advice, and sometimes it's because it's not working. And my answer is, if it's not working, you've tried everything possible, maybe it's time to try to think of something new. And there's lots of tricks for how you can start to think. And I say, but here's something you need to understand. It is always darkest before it gets even darker. And then if you keep pushing through, sometimes you get to see a glimmer of light. Okay. But your life is not unique. It's like that for all entrepreneurs. Overnight successes often take 13 years. And so finding somebody that's going to push through that darkness, the difference between success and failure. Look, brilliance is assumed or I wouldn't have funded you. A great idea is assumed or I wouldn't have funded you. A huge market is assumed or I wouldn't have funded you. The only secret to your entrepreneurial success is tenacity. Are you willing to fight through? Are you willing, like I'm fascinated with Navy SEALs and other elite soldiers. Are you willing to be one of that tiny percentage that no matter how hard it gets, does not ring the bell and go home? You just stick it out. You make it through. You get it done. Finding that is hard. And knowing that it's there is harder. It's not like you can just check a bunch of boxes, ask a bunch of questions and get that answer. You'll never be certain until after you're in the deal, and then you'll figure it out. But it's my constant quest to see if I can find the entrepreneurs with the great ideas in the big markets that also have the drive and tenacity to get there.
And I'm guessing this is why you named your firm Tenacity Venture Capital.
You got it. It's funny. I did a vote across three different names and Tenacity won, but even more than just winning, I had about half a dozen entrepreneurs reach out to me that I had funded by text and email to say, you've got to choose Tenacity. One person said, you got to choose it because it defines you, because I'm a pretty tenacious person, I think. And the other person, or several of them, were like, every entrepreneur knows how important that is. And yes, once you're an entrepreneur and once you're fighting through, you do learn how important it is. I don't know if everybody knows how important it is before they start. So it just seemed to resonate. Like in all the other names, I had one other email outreach after the fact. So if six people are willing to take the time to text or email, that means there's probably 10x behind them that didn't bother to do that, but have the same passionate commitment to the name. And I've got a lot of confidence in the name. I like the name because it explains, like, what are you looking for in an entrepreneur? Read the name. you know, there it is. Should be easy for you to understand, not for me to find it.
And what is the long-term goal with Tenacity Venture Capital? How do you envision it? As you've raised these funds over these past, few months here, right? You must have some long-term vision for how you foresee this going over the next few years.
Well, I mean, I like doing what I've done historically. I want to do more of that. I think it's a 20-year journey for me from here. It's fund half a dozen to, less than a dozen companies a year, seek out great IPO-worthy companies once they get to scale. I ultimately, I do this because I love it. I've done very well financially, personally, but, I'm not doing this as a charity. I do want to make money doing it. But I want to enjoy myself, and I enjoy myself with being able to help entrepreneurs. I really like working with them. And to be honest, good times or bad, I just like being able to help. So that's a big part of it. I want to make money for my LPs. I want to make money for myself. I want to have entrepreneurs succeed. Success is much more fun than the other type. net, it's raise fund one, deploy, raise fund two, deploy, raise fund three, deploy. And, when you think about what a VC or seed investor's job is, find companies, pick which ones to invest in, win the right to invest in them, which is not always easy, and help them as much as you possibly can to get to their goals. And then ultimately, you also have a responsibility to drive towards liquidity, because without liquidity, you can't give your money back to your LPs, and they're very unhappy if they don't get their money back. And it's not about giving their money back, it's giving their money back in multiples. So, that's what you spend all your time on. And I assume if I run the next three funds, it's 10 years to deploy the next three funds and 10 more years on top of that to help and harvest. So that feels like the right thing. Now, it's a sole GP fund. I've always enjoyed being an island. I have no issues with that at all. I may decide there are things I need that I need to hire for, but right now the plan is, it's sort of to be the Pappy Van Winkle of seed funds. It's funny. I used to write about food and wine and spirits. Pappy Van Winkle is the most sought after bourbon in the world. It sells for crazy money if you can get it. Brown-Forman is probably the largest spirits producer in the world. Brown-Forman has a tasting panel of probably 12 people to review everything they make and decide if it's good. Pappy Van Winkle has one, its founder. And his attitude is, if it's good enough for me, it's good enough for my customers. And that's sort of the way I think about, I do an enormous amount of work to get to conviction. Gary Little, who is a general partner with me at Canvas, used to say, I do seed with the diligence of a Series A, and once I've gotten there, I want to be able to make the investment. I don't need to be able to rush. I don't make an investment in a single meeting. I can only pass in a single meeting. It's going to take me multiple meetings to make a decision to invest. But once I get to that point, I really like the idea that I can then make the decision, shake that entrepreneur's hand and fund them, versus in a traditional venture partnership where that decision is just the start of a process where you have to bring a lot of other people along before you can fund them. You got to get the whole partnership there. And I've never really mastered that. I'm sure others have. I have not. I've been able to demonstrate that I can pick pretty well, and I've been demonstrating that I can generate returns from picking well. I have not been able to figure out how to, be the person that works the room adequately to get 25 other people to see the same thing I spent potentially years getting to, because sometimes it has been years in a category before I find the right opportunity.
So Ben, what have been some interesting book reads which have further developed your global perspective as a venture investor?
It's a common question, particularly among entrepreneurs, like, hey, what are the top two books you've ever read or anything else? And I have a couple of answers. One is, when you think about reading, you sort of end up trapped in either nothing or everything. You don't have a lot of time. You should really be focused on your business. So you may not have time to read, but reading is awesome and valuable and time and mind expanding. So the other answer is, read everything you possibly can. Diverse stuff, not in your core area of expertise. I mean, sure, there are tactical books like Predictably Irrational that help you think about pricing, but some of the best ideas I've had, the best sort of evolution of thought I've had that's helped me as an investor have been like hard science fiction. Snow Crash, when I was an early entrepreneur, really helped me understand a way the web would evolve in a way that was different than what I think most other people understood. There's been so much really awesome things, so many awesome things predicted through hard science fiction that would go on to be great businesses. And, you know, you can tell so many of these entrepreneurs are reading it because so many of their companies are named after it. Now, sometimes it's fantasy, you know, like Palantir, but like the first immersive three-dimensional world ever was called Black Sun, which came out of Snow Crash. And, you know, there's so much of this out there. So, you know, a hard science fiction also has the benefit of being fun to read, while, you know, nonfiction can be more of a journey. And, but it's all good. I live across the street from the library. I'll walk over there on the weekends. Last time I checked out 2 bags of books, I must have 25 books. And I'd sit by the pool and I'd read the first chapter of each one and I'd decide which to keep going in. But sometimes it just gives me a sort of brief perspective of, and there's a way to get these, I think it's called blinks, where you can get sort of the summaries of the books, but you know, you often don't have the time. I mean, you can read ultra specialized stuff in your industry. There's lots of blogs, there's people to follow. Audiobooks helps, but net, you got to get it done. So, you know, it's either everything or nothing in a lot of ways.
Ben, any last minute advice for our listeners?
Yeah, I think that, you know, even though there's a lot of jobs we have, making the right selection in the beginning is by far probably the most important. You know, you've got to have that super high quality team, super high quality idea, huge market. I mean, I go back to people, a great idea and a huge market if it works. I've got to have all of that. And, you know, if I'm accurate in picking those things, particularly on the quality of entrepreneur side, my likelihood of success is infinitely higher. I used to have a partner once who used to say they like to find opportunities that were, in her words, like I think the way she put it was, sometimes you find a house where the bones are good, but it needs work. I totally, completely disagree. Like, I am not interested in a fixer-upper. I just want to buy the best house in the best neighborhood. Or maybe it's not the best house in the best neighborhood, but it's certainly in the best neighborhood. So, you know, it's so important to make the right decision at the beginning. You know, there was a funny Silicon Valley episode where it was talking about how, you know, it was the one for those that have seen Silicon Valley about the sales team and how he's like, well, can't they sell this? And they're like, no, that's hard to sell. And he's like, well, isn't that what great salespeople do? Sell hard things. And he's like, no. The best salespeople want to sell the easiest things. They want to, you know, take something that's easy to sell and do a phenomenal job of selling it. And I think the best investors want to find the absolute best opportunities because, you know, they can have impact and they can help and they can, you know, catalyze things, but they need the baseline to be great to start with. And I think that is probably one of the biggest learnings I've had. I mean, there's hundreds of others, but, you know, picking well in the beginning is critical. Now, of course, you've got to be able to win. And I think a big part of winning is being able to prove. And I think I have about 109 entrepreneurs that'll be testaments to my ability to help, that you will be helpful. Everybody talks about how helpful they are. My entrepreneurs are the ones I want people to listen to. You know, I've had a bunch of them make little video recordings, little 1 minute or less videos. So if people want to hear from my founders what I do well, they can get it without having to bug the founders. You know, you've got to be able to win. And to be able to win, you've got to be able to prove that you added value. And there's no better way to do that than to have great founders that you've actually helped in a material way. So, you know, I do believe it's a pay it forward game. And I try to be helpful anywhere I can, including in situations where I've passed, because, you know, I was an entrepreneur for a long time. It's a hard, hard life. And I have a lot of respect for anybody that's willing to dedicate their entire life to something as risky and as wonderful as entrepreneurship. It is a really hard thing to be an entrepreneur. So if you're thinking about becoming an entrepreneur, you got to think about very honestly with yourself, how much pain you're willing to suffer, how far you're willing to go. How, you know, first of all, one thing I've learned that entrepreneurs should understand, work-life balance is a myth. You can get work-life balance if you work for IBM. You cannot have work-life balance if you're building a phenomenal startup. It's not an option. There's an old saying, work, family, golf, choose any two. I remember when I was going to school, I had an entrepreneurial professor who said to me, it was often so hard to balance the choice between my entrepreneurial efforts and my family. And he said, my biggest worry was that one day I'd have to choose. And this was what made me really sad. He said, I'm not sure if I had to choose that my family would win. And that always scared me. Like, I spent an enormous amount of time trying to make sure to maintain, you know, a commitment to my family. But look, bluntly, as an entrepreneur, you know what that meant? Weekends were sacred. That was it. The weeks, I could work 18-hour days. And that was an agreement I had with my wife. I can pull all-nighters all week long if I want, as long as I'm there on the weekends. So, you know, it's not, and by the way, I did exempt out certain times of year, like the 2 trade shows we went to, and certainly my IPO roadshow. I mean, for my IPO, we worked every day except one Sunday. And if we had taken 2 days off instead of one, I would not have a public company behind me. So, you know, it's like, if you're thinking about being an entrepreneur, you got to think about whether you're willing to give everything to it, because that's what it's going to take of you, whether you want it to or not. And if you're not ready for that, you know, reading about the successes of others and all this, like one of my friends said once, there's a huge difference between being a wantrepreneur and actually being an entrepreneur. It might sound easy. It might sound fascinating. Like, oh my God, I can't believe they did that. I could do that. But there's a lot of hard along the way. And if you're not ready for that, if you even wonder if you're not ready for it, I wouldn't even bother to start, because, you know, it's just not worth giving up later and have sacrificed all that you're going to have to sacrifice to do what it's going to take to be an entrepreneur. It's a wonderful world. It's a wonderful life. It comes with great experiences, even when it doesn't work out. You know, the personal growth. I've had people that have failed all the way to zero that have still said to me they wouldn't trade that experience for anything, because they learned so much more than they ever would have in a traditional corporate job. There's a lot of value in entrepreneurship, but it is really hard. And if you're not up for that, well, don't start.
Ben, it was a pleasure having you on Geeks of the Valley, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Always enjoy it. You take care. Thank you.